was a woodworking tool that used to be on every workbench until it just disappeared and everybody just forgot about it. But that's crazy. That couldn't happen. Could it? Well, maybe. A couple of weeks ago, I was messing around on the internet and I found this listing for woodworker's dogs or iron dogs or bench dogs. And I immediately thought, like, that's weird. We all know what a woodworking dog is. It's a peg that just sticks out of your workbench. I don't know what those things are, but those aren't dogs. But then I found another listing and another one, and then I found too many to ignore. And the more I looked at these pictures, the more I thought, you know what? Actually, these things might really be dogs. They might be woodworking dogs, because there's a long history of tools that have the word dog in the title, because they kind of look vaguely like dogs, like timber dogs. They're these big kind of metal staples that hold logs in place. Well, they sort of have the outline of a dog, or fire dogs that hold logs and maybe a spit for turning meat. Well, fire dogs have legs and a neck and kind of a head. They sort of look like dogs. So when I'm looking at these, I'm thinking, well, okay, these really might be dogs because they've got legs and a neck and a head. Maybe those pegs really aren't the dogs. Maybe this is the actual woodworking dog. And then I found an eBay auction with three of them for $40, and I thought, oh, I've got to pick these up because there's got to be a good video in these. And the box came, and I opened it, and then I only had more questions. For instance, maybe this is a woodworking dog. This is what it was traditionally called. Okay, fine. What do you do with it? It's not obvious, but the internet has plenty of theories. One website said that this is for holding thin or small stock for planing. I have no idea how that would work. Some other people think that this is a kind of planing stop that you drive into your workbench. Well, that's easy enough to test. It would have to go, I guess, like this, because you'd need the point going in this direction, and all of them have the point going this way. So this isn't like a left-handed one or something. And so you'd get it on your bench like this. That part's easy enough. Okay, and then what you have is like the worst planing stop ever in history. It's only got one point, so the work could rotate. It doesn't bite in very well. It's ridiculous. And listen, I'm in the planing stop business. Like, I know how a planing stop is supposed to work. They need to be like a couple inches wide at least, and they're a lot better if they have teeth. They hold on to the work much better. If you wanted a really simple planing stop that you could forge up, well, I think like a basic timber dog would be much better. Like, these dogs used to be very common for glue-ups and things like that. And one of these could make a really good planing stop. If I just hammered that into my workbench, okay, then I've actually got a pretty stable platform that I can plane against. This is pretty good, and it's like a tenth of the effort of making this whole big thing. So that didn't answer any questions. And I was looking at these much more carefully, and there was an interesting feature, especially on two of them. The point that engages with the wood is flat. So it's a broad piece of steel with a flat taper, kind of like a knife edge, not a point. And I know from smithing that a flat taper like this is, well, it's a lot harder to make. You've got to be doing it for a reason. And the more I was thinking about it, the more I thought, well, a flat sort of knife edge taper, that would be good if you were driving it into end grain, because it wouldn't split the end grain. More of a wedge-shaped taper, that would split your wood apart much more easily. So, okay, you have like a long body with two legs, and the legs are really good at fighting twisting. So it fights motion like this way. And then you have a point that seems specifically designed to drive into end grain. And that's when the light bulb went off. If this thing is supposed to fight twisting and get driven into end grain without splitting, I know what it is. This thing is basically a tail vise. And I know that sounds totally bananas, but let me show you how it works. First, it's only going to work with a toothed planing stop on the other side. So get your work and put it in there so that it's engaged really well. And then here's how this dog works to keep your work steady. You put it against the end grain just like this and drive it in there first. And then when you've got a good connection with the end grain, then you drive these other two ends into your workbench. And then you have the most incredible hold I think I have ever felt in woodworking. I've used benches with tail vices plenty of times before, and none of them hold the work any better than this. So obviously planing this way is fine, but more importantly, you can traverse. And the work is just held rock solid. Now, in modern times, the hand tool method for this is the doe's foot, batten, and the holdfast. And those work really great too. But holdfasts weren't always part of every woodworking tradition, and they kind of fell in and out of favor. I think there was a period where this was basically the tail vise for benches that didn't have tail vices. So I know what it is, but that still leaves some questions. Like, I work in the English style, where there's no tail vise, and your work usually isn't held down. You just sort of push it up against a stop and work that way. And I only have to lock my boards in place once in a while for stuff like traversing. And when I need to do that, I've got a bunch of tricks for holding the board steady with just like a little scrap of wood. I show that stuff on this channel all the time. So if I were a joiner or a cabinet maker working 200 years ago and somebody showed me one of these, I'd probably think, oh, that's clever. I would use something like that once a week, or maybe a couple of times a month when I really needed to lock a board in place. I wouldn't use it too much more than that because my style of woodworking doesn't call for it, and also you're driving it into your benchtop, so it chews up your bench a little bit. I would want something like this, but I wouldn't want to pay a ton of money for it. So the local blacksmith would have to forge one of these that was good enough to work, but also cheap enough that I'd be willing to pay for it, and the blacksmith would have to still make a profit. And is any of that possible? Only one way to find out. Contact! This is the Urban Forge, Cleveland's best school of blacksmithing and metal arts. It's a great place to learn smithing, and the owner is a lot of fun. Tim Cunningham and I have been smithing together for years, and he's a great teacher. Sometimes he has a group of us over to his shop to work on stuff, and this was the perfect time for me to figure out these iron dogs. Could I make one fast enough and cheap enough that the local woodworker could afford to buy it? I started with this half-inch square steel bar. It's thicker than I need, but it gives me extra material in case I screw up. I'm gonna start with the fork part of the project, since that's the tricky part. Here, I'm using the corner of the anvil to set a shoulder. It's going to define the fork part of the project while I work on it. I need to split this section in two, so I need to spread it out first. This is called a ribbon taper. It makes the stock thinner and wider, you know, like a ribbon. Now, remember that shoulder I put in the stock? You can see it right here. That shoulder works like a stop that I can feel. As I'm making this taper, I hammer in one spot and move the bar in and out. When the shoulder hits the edge of the anvil, that's my cue to change directions. I'm hammering that half-inch stock down to about a quarter-inch thick, and that takes several heats. I'm working the steel aggressively, which makes the edges kind of lumpy, so I'm constantly flipping the work up on edge to straighten and square it up. Now I've got the width I need, and it's time to split this end and make the fork. Tim holds the work while I use a slitting chisel to mark the split. I can't go all the way through with this lightweight tool, but this thin chisel is easy to keep on track, and I get the split started. Then I can come back with this much heavier top tool and concentrate on the cut without worrying if I'm making a straight line. It takes a couple of passes, but the split is nice and even. Now I want to separate the halves of the fork. I can use the corner of the anvil to get started, and then it's into the vise to use the top tool and just hammer the sections apart. And now the piece is too big to fit in the forge, so Tim opens up the side door. Getting the whole thing hot lets me get between the two pieces and work on that transition. It's pretty rough from the splitting. Then it's over to the horn of the anvil to start bending the legs around. I start close to the tip to support the joint, and then I move back to get a bigger radius as I bend the legs over. I'm doing these bends over a couple of heats and going slowly. It's a lot easier to take my time and do it once. And those legs are longer than I need, so they get a quick trim with the top tool. Then I can bend the tips over the edge of the anvil and start working on the body of the dog. It's getting awkward to work with this long piece, so we cut it free, and I can grab it with a pair of tongs. I start tapering the other end and make my right angle bend over the corner. Now the forging is done, and I'll do a little bit of wire wheel and filing to finish it up. And here's the finished piece. I have to admit, I'm kind of happy I just, like, finished it at all, because it was harder than I thought it would be. And mine actually works! You can hammer it into the wood and hammer it into the workbench, and it really holds the piece of work steady. I admit, I was feeling pretty proud of myself until I put mine next to one of the antique ones that was done by, like, an old-school blacksmith. And man, mine does not measure up so great compared to the old school one. Mine's fine, the shape is right, the proportions are good, all of that, but just the details, the surface finish, the crispness of the inside corners, the really consistent thickness of the stock. I mean, the real blacksmith-made ones are super nice. Obviously, I shouldn't be too hard on myself. I'm basically a hobby blacksmith. I don't even have my own smithing shop. And, you know, if I were forging as well as a professional smith, that would be weird. I'm doing okay for somebody who's, you know, been at it for a few years as a hobby. But it's interesting just looking at this and thinking, well, okay, it's not that difficult to make. It wouldn't be that expensive. I think the blacksmith could have knocked this out at the end of the day. You know, if the smith and his apprentice, they finished fixing that plow, and they had an extra half an hour, I bet one of them would have said, oh, Joey the joiner, he said he wants one of those dog things. And they could have knocked one of these out before dinner time. So an experienced blacksmith could probably make a good one pretty fast and pretty cheaply. Which does lead us to the question of where did these things go? Why did people stop using them? And I think my best guess is because you have to drive them into your benchtop. And it used to be, especially in America, much more common for woodworkers to have sort of quick, cheap benches that were nailed together out of kind of random wood. I saw a bunch of these when I visited Colonial Homestead recently, and I've shown lots of these benches over the years on this channel. If you built your bench quickly out of cheap wood, and if your top was replaceable, like the top of my bench is just screwed down so I can replace it, if you've got a bench like that, hammering something in, it's not really a problem. You don't care. I'm gonna hammer this into my bench a bunch of times. But the trend in woodworking has been more towards like very fine furniture type benches made out of expensive hardwoods. If you're working on like a Scandinavian cabinet maker's bench, you're not hammering anything into that bench. It really depends on what tradition you're in. And a lot of woodworking has moved more towards like fine cabinet making, which is totally fine, but those people aren't gonna hammer things into their benchtop. At the same time, I sort of feel like maybe there's a market for this, and I am in the tool business, you know? Compass Rose, my company, could make something like this. We've been talking about it, and we could have the main thing laser cut, and we'd have to bend the little hooks at the end, but I could do like 100 of these in a couple days if I just had to bend them. Just a long day in front of the forge, I could get it done. So, I don't know, if you'd be interested in having a tool like this for your workshop, leave me a comment down below. I'd be interested to know how many people would want something like this. And while you're thinking about it, go check out CompassRoseTools.com. We have a full line of tools for woodworkers, including planing stops, our sawyer's hooks, we have a great little dovetail square, and we just came out with our advanced joiner's mallet kit. It's a really simple three-piece kit that lets you make your own traditional joiner's mallet really quickly and easily. It's like an afternoon project. We'll leave a link to that down below. Patreon.com/Rex Kruger. I hate to say it, but the tool business is not keeping the lights on around here. Not by a long shot, actually. What makes these videos possible is my patrons, because we don't do sponsorships or read ads or take free tools from companies. Patrons make this stuff happen. And they get a bunch of rewards like all of our plans for free and early access to videos, early access to tools and Compass Rose discounts. It's a lot of stuff, but it's the least we can do for the people who make these videos possible. You can click the link down below and check out all the rewards that patrons get. And on top of all of those people, customers and patrons, we also really appreciate our viewers. Thanks so much for watching.